Of Fun with the FAR. My name is Patrick, your Fun with the FAR producer, and I'm joined today by our amazing host, Steve, and our special guest, Ryan Roberts. Before we begin, I have a couple of housekeeping announcements. During the episode, we will be giving out three passwords that will pop up on the screen and be announced. These passwords are necessary if you're seeking CLE, CLP, or CPE credit. To get the credit, please write the passwords down. Once the session's over, please log into the PCI website. You will see a survey with instructions on how to get credit under My Certificates and Courses. Please fill out the survey in order to get credit for the program. Now, if a password or poll is not available under My Certificates or Courses for you, you can submit your passwords to either Ophelia at publiccontractinginstitute.com or to Danny at publiccontractinginstitute.com. Additionally, there may be polling questions for your participation records. We do encourage all questions and comments which may be submitted in the chat. And if you have any technical difficulties, please don't hesitate to let me know. Now, in addition, we will be sending out a Fun with the FAR NCAA March Madness bracket on Monday. So expect that via email. And moving forward, we will also be having a pre-show 10 minutes prior to the start of each Fun with the FAR episode. Attendance isn't mandatory, but we'll be having fun conversations and some trivia. And with that, I will pass it on to the instructors.
Thank you, Patrick. And I personally am excited about this. We're calling it our Go Farther March Madness tournament bracket. It's not mandatory, but we're excited about that. We're going to give out prizes for the number one point winner. And we're also going to give out prizes to the three participants that beat my total score. So this is all about fun. It's all about guessing, just so you know. I find that, you know, there's no logical reason for who's going to win any given game. And the fun thing about March Madness is are the upsets. So hope you all can participate. We're going to give out some great prizes. I'm also going to be sending out to all of you what I call my FAR bracket challenge. And we'll be sending out with our next invitation for episode 6, a bracket that will basically have each FAR part compete against each other. So there'll be 52 brackets that will be at play. You'll see some of the more, what I'll call important parts might get a bye in the first round. But what I want you to do is fill in that bracket. And
just wanted to start
going with each other. I want you to identify which part is more important to what you do in your day-to-day job. That's something that I want you to do. We're going to give 100 FAR points to everybody who participates. And again, it's a fun exercise. It'll give me some insight as to what FAR parts are most important to you. And I always enjoy seeing what those responses are. So hopefully you're willing to join in on that. Again, not mandatory, optional, but hopefully a fun exercise for you all. All right, I'm with my good friend today, Ryan Roberts. And Ryan, what I have done in the prior four episodes of this season is I'd love to have you introduce yourself, give a brief description of your background, and also tell us how did you get into or choose government contracting for your career?
Wow, sure. I'll give you the full bio, and I'm going to add one thing to the agenda. And I hated to do this to you publicly yesterday, Steve, but you left me with no choice. I have a bone to pick with you, and I'll save that for the end. So we'll get to that at the end. But nice to I guess, be here with you all. My name is Ryan Roberts, as Steve said. I'm a partner in the Government Contracts Group of Shepherd Mullin. I'm the leader of our commercial products and services team and a co-author of what we call the GSA Schedule Handbook. It's about a two-decade-old treatise on the GSA Schedules program. So for better or worse, that means two things. One, this is the world that I live in every day. And two, I am a very, very boring guest at dinner parties. But here, I think I'll do just fine, especially with my good buddy, Steve. As to my background and how I wound up in the government contracting field, so I went to GW Law, which produces, I'd say, approximately 94.6% of all government contracts lawyers. So went through Went through the GW program on government contracts, ended up being the editor-in-chief of the Public Contract Law Journal, which is the ABA journal that focuses exclusively on government contracts issues. It's kind of unique in the procurement world and across law schools generally, I guess. So some would say that government contracting chose me, not the other way around, but I'm very happy it did. And lastly, let's just get this out of the way now, Steve, because it's been hanging over us for a year. My last appearance on the show was my fifth, and I was very excited. I was very excited to be inducted into the Five Timers Club. Happy to be doing this with you, but I had one very simple request. All I asked for was my silk robe, just like the five-time club hosts on SNL get. They have the fancy silk robe, they get the little emblem on the chest, and I've been waiting for 364 days, and not a single package has shown up with this robe. So again, I hated to put you on blast publicly, but the world needed to know that I'm still waiting.
Well, you know, here at Fun with the Fire, we don't give out robes, but what we do give out, and I'm really, really happy about this, Ryan, is you're going to get your own I Had Fun with the FAR Season 10 commemorative T-shirt celebrating a decade of fun, of which you've been part of for 5 years, going into your sixth year now. So we're really, really excited to have you, Ryan. You come with a wealth of information. From my perspective, this is a plug. I find Shepard Mullen, the group that you have, is one of the top government contracts firms that I've ever personally worked with. So I'm really, really happy that you're going to join with us. Not only are you smart, you're articulate, but you're fun. So I'm really excited about our conversation today about FAR Part 8, 38, 39, and a snippet of FAR Part 51 that involves federal supply schedule contracting. But before we start our conversation, Ryan, we're going to ask our participants a few questions about our prior episode and see how well they listen. So Patrick, let's jump into the review questions.
First one should be up for everyone.
All right, question number one, agencies are required. Patrick, can you read that for me? It just jumped out of my...
Yes, no worries. It says, agencies are required to perform acquisition planning and market research to promote which of the following? A, use of pre-existing contracts. B, use of non-commercial item procurements. C, use of sole source procurements. Or D, all of the above.
So what is the purpose? What is one of the stated purposes for market research?
85% say all of the above.
All right. Well, 85% of you, unfortunately, are not correct. The correct answer is A, pre-existing contracts. B would have been correct if it was commercial item procurement, to promote commercial item procurements. C would have been correct if it was to promote competitive procurements, not for sole source. So the correct answer there was A. Correct answer is A. All right, let's go to the second question.
Are you able to see it this time, Steve?
I do. All Which right. type of contract requires the government to specifically identify the rate of liquidated damages per day of delay? Is it A, supply contracts, B, services contracts, C, construction contracts, or D, all of the above? And again, which type of contract requires the government to identify the rate of liquidated damages per day of delay? I'll even go a little bit further and said, what would be the most appropriate contract to contain the liquidated damages clause. All right.
Another blowout. Yeah, it says 76% say construction contracts.
Fantastic. 76% of you are correct. Construction contracts, especially the important ones, where the scheduled delivery completion date is critical for the mission, from my perspective, should contain a liquidated damages clause. Now, remember, the reason why there is a per day amount for each day of delay, because it's an estimate. It's, you use liquidated damages when you truly can't calculate what the actual damage will be. The actual amount per day of delay that a contractor would have to pay cannot be perceived as being punitive. So it can't be excessive. And we also talked about the government's requirement to not continually have a contractor pay off on a day-to-day basis for delay in lieu of terminating the contract for default. Ryan, any thoughts on liquidated damages from your perspective?
They're a pain in the butt. Is that what you had in mind? Yeah, they're really, I don't know. We see this in a couple of different contexts, and they always seem like a draconian punishment to me and never really fit the bill for the end the government's trying to achieve. So I'm outside counsel defending fraud cases, right? So of course I'm going to be opposed to liquidated damages, but logically I just don't see why they make sense in context for most of the areas in which they're incorporated in the FAR.
I mean, the important thing from the buyer's perspective is there has to be some basis of reason for that calculated amount. And it's not unusual for contractors to question the amount that's set forth in the liquidated damages clause prior to the submission of proposals based upon industry standard, for example. If the government's calculation isn't consistent with industry standard, contractors should bring that to the contracting officer's attention. And I will also say sooner than later, to the extent that you can be talking to your contracting officer again in that pre-acquisition stage, during acquisition planning, during the market research, share that information with the government if you're doing construction. Okay, let's next question. All right, which of the following is not an inherently governmental procurement function? Is not. Is it A, participating as a voting member of a source selection board? Is it B, awarding a contract? Is it C, accepting or rejecting a contractor's products or services? Or D, evaluating contractor proposals? Which of the following is not an inherently governmental procurement function, which means the government could award a contract for a contractor to perform that service. Okay. The correct answer here is D. D, evaluating contractor proposals. The reason why A is not correct is because a contractor is not permitted to be a voting member of an evaluation board. They're permitted to assist or support the evaluation board, but they're never going to have a vote. That is restricted to government employees only. Awarding a contract is not correct because, Ryan, the only person who can perform that function is?
Warranted contracting officer.
Bing. Absolutely right. So B is wrong. C, accepting, rejecting contractors, products, or services. That is also a function of a contracting officer. But as we recall from episode one, that is a function that can be delegated to a contracting officer's representative, but that person is also required to be a government employee. So C is not correct. D is correct because the contractor, a contractor is permitted to evaluate proposals, and the evaluations are then shared with board members. But the ultimate decision with regard to the actual scoring or recommendations from the board need always to be made by those government employees who are on that board and not the contractor themselves. So again, the correct answer here is D.
And all just right, one quick note there, Steve, for the contractor folks on the line, though we're permitted to do, you know, D, we can provide input and make a procurement recommendation. Just be aware that that's where you get OCI concerns pop up in the context specifically of protests. So we do a lot of OCI work around, you know, did we have any role in evaluating or drafting specification, anything along, if you're involved in the procurement process, it can preclude you from competing for the award. So just keep that in mind.
Absolutely. And we're going to be talking about OCIs in our discussion with FAR Part 9. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if you're a company and you're interested in performing those evaluation services, you've made a big decision to chase those types of contracts, but you will never be permitted to both be evaluator and receive an award in which you might be evaluating. So again, it's always important to make that corporate business decision very carefully. All right, next question. All right, which defense priorities in allocation system contract rating provides the highest order of precedence? Is it a DIY rated order? Is it a DM rated order? Is it a DO rated order? Or is it a DX rated order? For those of you who reviewed the guidebook or participated in the preparation assignment, this one should be easy for you. And I think we might have also talked about it in the show 2 weeks ago. Okay, let's close that poll, Patrick. You're absolutely right. 84% of you were listening. A DX rated order is the highest level of precedence under the DPAS system. What I always use with regard to a mnemonic device is X over O and O over no. So the unrated orders, of course, are the lowest precedence. DO is secondary, but the DX rated order is primary. So if you have contracts with the government, and one is rated a DO order, and you have no DX rated orders, the DO rated order will have precedence over anything else you might be working on at that time. And the government can tell you to solely focus on that work at the expense of all other contracts. The same thing with regard to DX and DO rated contracts that you might have. If the DX rated order, if the government invokes its ability under DPAS to say sole focus on that DX rated order at the expense of all other orders, you're required to do that. It's also important for you to inform your other contract, your other buyers, that the government has invoked this order on this other contract, and it will create a delay under your other existing contracts. When the government invokes that order, it acts as a basis for an excusable delay. So the government cannot then say, we're going to terminate for default these orders that had to stop. The government cannot do that. As you remember, we talked about 2 weeks ago, if you have a rated order, a DX rated order or DO rated order in your company, it is very important if you also do commercial work and you're using the same source or the same line to manufacture, say, equipment, you need to make sure in your commercial contract that you have an excusable delay clause or your force majeure clause that says, in the event the government takes action. And you can even say, under the Defense Procurement Allocation System, that is a basis for an excuse for a delay in your commercial contracts, and that those buyers cannot then terminate your commercial contracts for default. Ryan, any other thoughts on that before we start our episode?
I don't think so. I don't think you told them the days. Do they remember the days? That should have been a follow-up trivia question. How many days they have to respond?
To a DPAS rated order?
Yeah, depending on the category.
That's a good question. You know what? I'm going to give an I Had Fun with the FAR Season 10 t-shirt to the first person who can tell me that answer.
Well, say for DX. How many do you get for DX? There we go.
All right, check. I'll let you answer that, Ryan, because you stumped my band.
Well, I got to see the first person to say 10. Let's scroll up here. So you get 10 for DX, 15 for DO.
Okay, so the first person who said 10, Patrick, is our winner. I believe that's Lindsay. Lindsay, congratulations. You just wanted a Season 10 I Had Fun with the FAR t-shirt. Great job on that. And Brian, you get a Ooh. Ring of the bell for that great trivia question. So, all right.
Let's, Two rings before the session even started.
Before it even started, you're already getting the ring the bell. All right, so let's jump into episode 5. And we've tied a series of FAR parts together. And there's always a method to my madness when I consolidate some of these FAR parts for a given show. And I'll give an I Had Fun with the FAR Stress Guy to the first person who can tell me what these four particular FAR parts have in common. What do they have in common? And more importantly, why? So while we're waiting to hear, Ryan, let's talk a little bit about FAR Part 8, which the FAR Council entitles Required Sources of Supplies and Services. Required Sources of Supplies and Services. And I think in a little bit, we'll find out why that might be a misnomer to some extent, because not all the acquisitions in this particular FAR part are required. And when we look at FAR Part 8, the purpose of the part is to establish rules and procedures for the acquisition of supplies or services from or through what are referred to as government supply sources. And the first question I'll throw out to you, Ryan, is when they say a government supply source, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, that is a good question, because there are a number of sources from which the government can buy supplies, right? So I think a narrow interpretation here, at least for me on the outside counterpart, you think of your contractor clients, right? You're a source of supply, but there are actually a number of programs through which the federal government has to purchase before you even get to potential contractors. So that's what I think it means. What about you, Steve?
Well, I think that when we talk about a government source of supply, it is a very specific source that more often is going to deal with pre-existing inventory, for example, that the government has already procured or built itself. And it's waiting in a warehouse. And the source of supply is going to save the money. It's going to save the government money because it's already been bought. And a contractor can use that inventory to fulfill maybe a larger mission. We're going to talk a little bit more about government furnished property during our episode where we talk about FAR Part 45. FAR Part 8 also is driven with regard to required sources of supply from socioeconomic purposes. And in a little bit, we're going to talk about two specific socioeconomic programs that the government is saying contractors, a first preference should be these programs. And again, the reason for that is it's going to have some benefit to these socioeconomic programs that help the greater community per se. When we take a look at FAR 8.002, it establishes priorities of items or sources that the government buyer, the contracting officer is supposed to look at before they even issue a standard open procurement. And with regard to supplies, when the government has a need for a supply, the first place, the highest precedence, is they need to look at the current agency's inventories. And I would also add to that, the agency's inventories, as well as there's some requirements for the government to seek out if another agency might have that supply that's in excess that can be used. The third level of precedence is the what's called the federal prisons industry, also now referred to as UNICOR. UNICOR. The fourth level of precedence is what's called the Ability One program, which is a list of supplies that is manufactured or provided by the committee for purchase from people who are blind or severely disabled. And then the last required source of supplies is the GSA, VA, or DLA stock program, which is a very specific type of program that the government has established for supplies. With regard to services, the first preference is to go back to the Ability One program. So the government is saying to these government buyers, before you make a decision to issue a standard procurement, you need to see if any of these other sources are available to provide you with a good or service. But we need to recognize that the FAR Council tells us that these priorities, they're not absolute. And that the source, these other sources must be able to provide the specific supply that's needed, or the specific service that's needed, by the time it's required and the quality that's required must be satisfactory to the agency. Now, the committee for the purchase for people who are blind or severely disabled, they actually have a procurement list. And UNICOR, which we're talking about, the federal prisons industry, has an established list of supplies. And they're not all inclusive. I mean, the bottom line is that they are inclusive. If the government has a need for that specific listed supply, the next question is that supply, does it meet our quality requirements? And if the answer is yes, then they need to make a determination as to whether that particular source of supply can deliver it in the time that's needed. And if the answer is yes to both those questions, then that source of supply should be used. If the answer is no, then it's open for a competitive process under FAR Part 15, a invitation for bid process under FAR Part 14, and we're going to talk about this procurement process under FAR Part 8 that involves the federal supply schedule or the use of federal FAR Part 12 commercial item procurements. And I believe my good friend Ralph correctly identified the theme. And all of these particular FAR parts that I've lumped together involve the federal supply schedule. And the reason why I jumped in FAR Part 39, Ryan, and we've talked about that, is I'm not sure if it's still true today, but the GSA schedule is the predominant procurement vehicle for the purchase of information technology products and services today, commercial products and services. And we're talking, what do you think the millions of dollars is up to? Is it we're in the billions now for GSA schedules for what otherwise we used to be called Schedule 51?
We're in the billions. I mean, across the schedules program, all previously referred to schedules, last year was 40 billion. I don't have the breakdown by now large category and small category, but it's a safe assumption it's in the billions.
And one of the things we're going to get to is when the government uses FAR Part 8, it needs to take into account what specific things it might be buying under a federal supply schedule. And they need to apply these other FAR Part rules when they made that acquisition. So if they're going to be acquiring information technology, that contracting officer who is putting in that order needs to be aware of the rules from FAR Part 39. Okay, Ryan, let's talk about FAR Part 8. And I still to this day scratch my head as to why when we talk about the federal supply schedule at FAR 8.4, why they don't just do a cut and paste and throw it into FAR Part 38 that's entitled Federal Supply Schedule Contracting.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for you. I think thematically,
if I was the FAR counsel for the day and I had a magic wand, that's what I would do.
Pull out the
Federal Supply Schedule program from FAR Part 8 for a very specific reason. The Federal Supply Schedule is not required. The government's not required to use it. So again, we look at the title of FAR Part 8, required sources of supplies and services. The federal supply schedule is not a mandatory source. It is a non-mandatory source. But before we get further into the weeds, Ryan, talk to us a little bit about what the federal supply schedule program is and why it's almost ubiquitous in the procurement field. When a new contractor goes to the government, one of the first words they're asked is, do you have a GSA schedule contract under the federal supply schedule program? What is it, just briefly, because some of the folks out there might not be familiar with it.
Yeah, the benefit on both sides is pretty clear. So on the government side, you get GSA doing a lot of the hard legwork for you. GSA is evaluating offers, making price reasonableness determinations, and giving you a handy dandy price list to buy goods, services that have already been vetted, both from a contractor responsibility standpoint and prices, offerings, et cetera. So it makes the procurement process easy on the government side. And on the contractor side, you essentially get a license to go hunt. You get your products pre-approved by a federal agency. It makes your marketing easier. It makes your onboarding with other customer agencies easier. It just streamlines the process. So if you think about how a typical procurement would work, the ordering CO would be responsible for doing all of that work, soliciting offers, reviewing proposals, making those determinations. Here, at times, it can be as easy as going onto GSA eBuy, plugging in the keywords for what you're looking to buy, compare prices across a couple of offers, documenting it, and off you go. So really, the main benefit is streamlining the process for buying commercial products and services for federal customers.
And the important note to make is the Federal Supply Schedule program is only for items, which include supplies or services that have been determined to be commercial. So it's not for all products and services, it's just for those that are otherwise defined as commercial under FAR 2.101. And we're going to talk about the commerciality rules in our discussion in another episode that covers FAR Part 12. But it's for a very small, a niche. And the government historically, and we're talking about before the FAR, before 1984, the government initially only used the Federal Supply Schedule program to purchase supplies and not services. That occurred later in the 1980s. But it's important for us to understand that the government, under what's called the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the Federal Acquisition Reform Act, made it easier for contracting officers to expand their procurement authority to purchase commercial services under the Federal Supply Schedule. And that caused the schedule to boom. And I would also add to Ryan's comment with regard to the benefits for the contractor is for many of these new contractors that entered the government procurement world in the 80s, one of the things they pushed very hard for is to make any terms or conditions for commercial items, supplies or services, that they be purchased under what are more similar to the commercial terms and conditions that they use when they sell to a commercial customer. And that had some, when the government made that decision to do that, that had a lot of appeal, which again expanded the supplier base to the government for these commercial items. The government also made a decision to carve out certain compliance rules that contractors traditionally were always required to follow. The most important, and we're going to talk about this a lot more detail in the future, are the requirement for a contractor to disclose the costs that it incurs to provide a service or to provide a supply to the federal government customer. In a federal supply schedule, the contractor presents to the government a price without any underlying information as to what builds up that price. Now, Ryan, in the non-commercial space, the government says, I need that cost information to determine whether a contract price is fair and reasonable. Why don't they need that under a federal supply schedule program?
Well, the theory is because your commercial sales of not just you, but also your competitors demonstrate that the pricing you're offering is fair and reasonable. So those commercial sales are the truth check there to validate your pricing as opposed to your cost buildup. Traditionally, there are some exceptions to that under the schedules program.
Another ring. You're absolutely right there, Ryan. I think the thought process is, and again, it was part of the rules that a lot of commercial contractors insisted upon for them to want to enter the government marketplace. And this whole concept of a contractor telling the government, this is what I sell, this is the price I offer to my commercial customers for the same product or service. So you should take that as an indication that that's what these market forces, right? Free market enterprise has determined what's fair and reasonable. Ryan, let's talk about federal supply schedule contracting. because the FAR Council talks to us about two contracting officers. There's the Federal Supply Schedule Procurement Officer, who awards the overall contract to a contractor. And then there's an ordering activity contracting officer who issues task orders or delivery orders under the contract that's already been awarded. Talk to us a little bit about how that happens.
Yeah, it's a fascinating process, especially when those two contracting officers aren't aligned. And, you know, that's typically when we come in. So we probably see more than that than there's out there in the general universe. But theoretically, the way the contracting process works is you as a contractor submit your, we'll call it an application to GSA to get on the schedules program. As we've alluded to the extent you have commercial sales, those are vetted to establish fair and reasonable pricing. To the extent you don't have commercial sales, then you have to submit something to validate your pricing. And typically that's a cost buildup. So the whole thing that the commercial entities are trying to avoid by using the schedules program actually does come into play more commonly than you think. So you go through the application process, and we're at a weird state of flux with the schedules program, depending on whether you opt into something called the transactional data reporting rule or want to live in the old commercial sales practices format framework. I just mentioned those two terms so you know they exist. There are different ways of ensuring compliance with the schedules program and place different obligations on the contractor. Anyway, once you are on schedule, you have widgets at prices pre-approved by GSA, then the Department of Energy, just picking an agency, contracting officer can say, hey, I need that widget. Let me go look at the schedules program, log on to GSA Advantage, search for widget, look at prices, document three offers, place that order with whoever represents the lowest cost alternative to the federal government, typically.
Right. One of the things that's very unique about the Federal Supply Schedule contract is it's one of the few times a contracting officer is going to award a contract. And I'm going to carve out sole source contracts without competition. And what the contracting officer is going to determine when awarding a federal supply schedule contract to an individual contractor is they'll, of course, do a responsibility determination. Is this contractor responsible? And we're going to talk about what responsibility is in a later episode, but it's basically, are they qualified to perform under a federal government contract? Are they providing a commercial item, a supplier service that is under a schedule? Is the quality of the product or service offered, has it been proven? And is the price that is offered by the contractor, and Ryan made a very, very important use of a term of art with regard to not the lowest price, but, and to some extent, a fair and reasonable price, but it's a broader determination. And when he refers to alternative is important. Once the contracting officer awards that contract, the life of that contract is pretty lengthy, Ryan. Can you tell us what the standard length of a federal supply schedule contract is?
Yeah, and some you're looking at typically 20 years, first 5-year period and then 3 5-year options. So if you're doing it the right way, you're having a contract for at least 20 years.
So that is significant to a commercial item contractor. In essence, they will have a long-term contract with the federal government for nearly 20 years. The government there's an expectation at the end of that first five-year period, the government is going to renegotiate your contract to some extent. They have the ability to renegotiate your contract for the next 5 years, and for the next 5 years after that, and for the next 5 years after that, because they're options. More often than not, if a contractor has successfully sold a product or supply to federal government buyers, they will retain that contract for that long term. In any given period of time, Brian, what happens with regard to the initial pricings that you offer, and is it ever subject to change?
Well, it depends. We've had some unique market forces over the last couple of years. Historically, the thought was, as you make more of the same thing and you offer discounts to other customers, theoretically, that price for that same product decreases over time. That being said, there is an escalation clause in every GSA schedule contract that permits you to increase prices as costs go up. And we've seen record-breaking levels of increased costs of supplies, materials, you name it, over the last few years. So you do have the ability to seek an increase. That it, the amount of increase and the frequency with which you can request the increase is capped by the FAR reg. So it's a fascinating program in that you have this push and pull where you have repeated sales. The government wants to receive the benefit of discounts you're offering to other customers, while at the same time you do see prices increasing because of market forces. So it's part of the challenge in contract administration that, quite frankly, we deal with regularly.
Now, Ryan, I talked earlier about the government's opportunity to change the terms and conditions of a federal supply schedule contract during its lifetime. Is there ever an instance where a contractor can change the terms, can bring up new terms or conditions for the government under the existing contract?
Sure. You can seek a modification to your contract. But in my experience, it really just depends on what you're selling. So, for example, if you're selling the same widget over and over again, standard terms, not much to change there. Our tech clients, on the other hand, they have, you know, end user license agreements, master subscription terms, terms of service that change. I don't want to say daily because I don't want to sound dramatic. So we'll say weekly. They change weekly. And oftentimes we have to incorporate those revisions as new terms and conditions into our schedule contract that apply to orders. So you certainly have the opportunity to change those terms and conditions. I will say one of the big critiques of the schedules program specifically, you know, as compared to NASA Soup or some of the other big vehicles, it just takes a long time to get those modifications through. So our advice always is to clients, be very, very comfortable with that initial offer because there's a good chance you're stuck with those terms and conditions for a long period of time.
And Stephen, right. if we could hop into our...
I hear someone wants a password and they're absolutely correct.
Yes. Well... So our first password of the day is actually FIRST, F-I-R-S-T.
All right. And Ryan, we got a really, really good question from Lori. And she asks, what are the main differences between a FAR Part 12 and a FAR Part 8 federal supply schedule contract?
Yeah, I think the answer starts with what those two parts cover, right? So think about FAR Part 8, you know, at least as we're talking about here, as the federal supply schedule program, whereas FAR Part 12, you're talking more commercial items generally. So you can buy commercial items through a number of vehicles, not necessarily just the FSS program, but at least in my head, thematically, that's how I split the two of them up. But Steve, tell me why I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, I think the big difference, Ryan, is what a contracting officer doesn't need to do. And again, I'm going to say, when I refer to contracting officer, I'm talking about an ordering contracting officer, right? So I'm presuming a FAR Part 8 contract already exists. When a contracting officer might have an end user saying, hey, I need a commercial item. And in that instance, the contracting officer has really two avenues, presuming it's over the simplified acquisition threshold. And that is to use the rules in FAR Part 12 or use the rules in FAR Part 8. And one of the big differences is the ordering activity under FAR Part 8 is not required to do a responsibility determination. So they don't have to do that. That's already been done. They don't have to do any acquisition planning because that's already been done. They don't necessarily have to do the same market research because the government has already done that. The government also doesn't necessarily have to do much with regard to price determination, reasonable price determination, because again, the initial price that's on a schedule is presumed to be fair and reasonable. Now, the FAR Council tells contracting officers, you have an obligation to ask for better pricing, but if you don't get it, that's okay. And there's also some other rules in FAR Part 8 we're going to talk about that are a little different with regard to sole source pricing. Under FAR Part 8, the contracting officer does not have to publicize the procurement through SAM.gov. Instead, the government uses an automated system called GSA eBuy. And the universe of sellers, when you use GSA eBuy, are only those contractors that possess a federal supply schedule contract. When you do FAR Part 12, your universe is larger. You can procure items from somebody who's not on the schedule. So FAR Part 8 is there to help streamline the process. The other interesting thing with regard to FAR Part 8, Ryan, is a FAR Part 12 contract does not require that the contractor pay what's called the industrial funding fee. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, what did you think? GSA was doing all this hard legwork for free? Come on, Steve. Right. No, they want their little something for the caddy too. So yeah, your IFF fee is built into your schedule price as a contractor. That's important. It's not a fee that you tap on. It has to be included in the price you negotiate with the federal government up front. And then that 0.75% is remitted back to GSA by the contractor each quarter. So for contractors on the line, the important point there is to the extent you want to get involved with the schedules program, you need to have a system for capturing and segregating GSA sales, accumulating that 0.75 in a little piggy bank and a system for remitting it through GSA system once a quarter.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping that we were able to answer that question, but it's a great one. Thank you for asking that. We talked about GSA eBuy. Now, I think, Brian, back when I started doing federal supply schedule contracting, back in the late 80s and early 90s, one of the significant differences in GSA schedule contracting was the use of automation. And the General Services Administration used, I think, from my perspective, Ryan, the federal supply schedule to spearhead a lot of automation. And one of the things that it created very early is what's called GSA Advantage. And GSA Advantage was one of the first sources for federal government buyers to find contractors who were providing a specific service or providing a specific supply with pricing and with what, as Ryan referred to, with terms of services, which I normally would say these are terms and conditions that the contractor is going to insist upon, or what I'll call limitations, maybe, that the government would ordinarily request. And it made it very easy for the government to identify sources for competition. So I always like to say that the GSA eBuy is kind of like the catalog. And the GSA eBuy system is the automated system that the government uses to buy something off a contractor's catalog. The GSA eBuy is an electronic request for quotation system, RFQ. That's different from a request for proposal. That's issued under a FAR Part 15 procurement or a FAR Part 12 procurement or an invitation for bid that's issued under FAR Part 14. And again, this is all automated. The government issues the solicitation, tells the contractors, here's what we're looking for. Here's the delivery date that we're seeking. Here's the terms of quality that we're seeking. Here are the terms and conditions that we're going to purchase that product or supply under. And GSA eBuy provides a portal for the contractors to send an automated response. And it was one of the first procurement systems that allowed contractors to do that. They were no longer mailing proposals. They were no longer faxing proposals. They were no longer hand carrying proposals in response to a government request. That, of course, created some issues, Ryan, with regard to the use of automation. And I always tell my clients, like any other automated system, stuff happens. So if there is a deadline for your response, your proposal responding to an RFQ, don't push that button at the last and the 11th hour. Because again, it's not when you push the button, it's when the government's automated system receives it. So always make sure that you give yourself a sufficient amount of time. Ryan, I can't count the number of times where we were holding our breaths, hoping that the government, we got a return receipt from the government that was on time. Because again, stuff happens. And sometimes the government says too late, we can't help you.
Yeah, late is late. There's big signs on every government building.
Multiple times throughout the year. Okay, we've got a question here from Teresa. Speaking of SAM.gov, it is experiencing an unexpected outage and it appears the system is generating false emails. Until resolved, they are asking that you not click on any links in any emails you may receive until the system is confirmed as fully operational. Thank you for that public service announcement, Teresa. That's pretty scary stuff. I'm hoping that's not because there's some form of bug in the system.
But Steve, what were you saying about automation? It just always works perfectly, never an issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, Barbara makes a good question, Brian. How is the use of GSA scheduling different from an auction?
Yeah, so reverse auctions are a common procurement vehicle, particularly at DoD, for certain products and services. But I would describe the GSA eBuy system as very different from a reverse auction. Reverse auction, typically, you know a number of offers in the room and you see the bids in decreasing value, right? You start at 100 million down to 90, 80, et cetera, right? The eBuy system is here's what we want. You submit your offer directly to us. Your other competitors don't see your pricing, your offering. The government sees all, contracting officer sees all, and then makes their determination, relays that determination back to the offerors. So the visibility and transparency, I think, is the primary difference between the two procurement methods.
Ryan, let's jump to 8.405, which is the ordering procedures, because there's some significant nuances based upon the thresholds and whether you're buying supplies, whether you're buying services, whether their service is based upon a statement of work. Tell us what a how a contractor can use the ordering procedures potentially to its benefit, and what's been your experiences as far as issues or concerns with the government's use of ordering procedures?
Yeah, so the thresholds here are fascinating, particularly in context of, you know, I make a living being critical of GSA, right? Like that's what I'm paid to do as outside counsel. But GSA doesn't get enough credit for trying to advance the ball on technology. And we're seeing that specifically with the 846 program that directly impacts these purchasing thresholds. So Steve, have you guys actually covered the various dollar thresholds in the FAR and what's required at each?
We are going to be talking about the simplified acquisition thresholds in our conversation in FAR Part 13. We haven't got there, but I think what I'm wondering, Ryan, is how those dollar thresholds impact how many contractors, for example, the government actually needs to seek responses to an RFQ.
Got it. Yeah, and you know, based on the various thresholds, you start at the bottom with the micro purchase threshold, which is what I call the Wild West of federal procurement, even though that's only slightly tongue in cheek. And then you work your way up through the simplified acquisition threshold, and then go all the way up through full and open procurement. So specifically within the schedules program, there are differentiators between whether or not you need a statement of work. So certain services do require a statement of work just because you can't actually submit a quote without having that statement of work. But nonetheless, as you increase in value, you're required to seek an increased number of offerors. So micro purchase threshold, you can essentially walk into a store, we'll use that as the equivalent, and buy whatever you want. You walk into a Staples with a credit card and buy your pack of pens, nobody's going to bat an eye. But as you get above that simplified acquisition threshold, you have to document a couple of offerors to make sure you're making a good purchasing decision on behalf of the federal government.
I'm not sure if we have any business development folks out there, or if there's anyone out there that is thinking about getting into business development. If you learn 8.405, to the extent where it's, you know it better than anyone else in your company, you are an invaluable asset. Because I've always found, Ryan, that the business development people, that the contracting procurement people who worked for me, who were familiar with these rules, will always have an advantage over the competition. And their companies are going to do better. So if I were to say to you all out there, you spend any time in reading FAR Part 8, 8.405 is the most important because it shows you how the government can make purchases or can order under a FAR Part 8 federal supply schedule contract. And it differs. The one thing that I will always say, because under certain circumstances, the government has the ability to limit the number of contractors that it sends an RFQ to. Remember, it's a request for a quotation. There are situations where the government, again, is going to send the RFQ out under GSA eBuy to potentially six contractors that it believes can provide the service or product at the quality that's necessary and under delivery terms that are required. If you as a contractor learn that the government has issued an RFQ to a small limited number of contractors and you want to participate, my recommendation is that you send an email to that contracting officer and say, I want to play as well. And the contracting officer cannot say no. The FAR Council makes clear that ordering contracting officers are required to provide RFQs to any scheduled contractor that may request a copy of it. And I will add, if you have learned of this RFQ, the day before the proposals are due, from my perspective, Ryan, that contractor, if they're qualified, may have a right to tell the government, not only do I want you to send it to me, but I'd like you to extend the due dates for proposals.
Yeah,
you that need to make sure that you properly support why it's in the government's interest to do that.
Yeah, Absolutely. And you know, when we have to make that argument, we typically rely on the foundational principles of the system, right? You want to increase competition. Increased competition drives lower prices. So that's typically the rationale behind our pitch to extend that deadline. The important point, again, for contractors on the line, still proceed with preparing that proposal as if you're not going to get that extension, because if it doesn't come through, you're going to be required to submit that, you know, 10 hours later or whatever it is.
What I've often recommended to contractors who have a federal supply schedule contract, in the event you have a feeling that an RFQ is in the process, and you have an inkling that the government's going to be issuing an RFQ soon, that you actually send an early email to the procurement office and to say, it's my understanding that the government might have a specific procurement need that we can fulfill. You might attach some background information. To the extent the government issues a RFQ for this need, please send me that RFQ so I can provide a response. So you're almost sending an early shot across the bow saying, don't forget me, because I'm here and I'm available and I am ready to provide you with the product or service that you need. And then if the government doesn't send you that RFQ, you're in a better position to say, I need that extension, because now I know you did. Just a thought. All right. Ryan, Patrick, I think we're ready for another password.
Yes, that sounds good to me. Password two. SOAP. S-O-A-P. All right.
All right, Ryan. At FAR 8.402, the FAR Council talks about off-schedule purchases. And these are for items that aren't identified in the federal supply schedule contract that you might, that you have possession of, and you might be providing services under or products under. What's an off-schedule purchase? And how does the government include that in a federal supply schedule contract?
Yeah, there are actually a couple of different ways now based on some regulatory changes over the last, I don't even remember now, but maybe 5 years. So one, you can sell as a contractor, sell items to the federal government as open market items. So what open market designation means is they are not at pre-negotiated prices. They're not products or services that are pre-approved on your GSA schedule. They're not on the catalog, right? GSA hasn't looked at them and vetted them. Nonetheless, the ordering entity, CO, wants to buy them from you, and for sake of convenience, wants to buy them from you via the same delivery order, task order they're issuing under the schedules program. So you can do that. The compliance consideration there for contractors, just make sure they are designated as open market items. It becomes critical for IFF retention purposes, audit purposes, you name it. Make sure it's clear and it's on your invoice. The other method through which you can sell things to the government not on your schedule is this new category, that SIN, I guess you call it now, where you can sell things to the federal government that aren't on your federal supply schedule as long as it doesn't exceed a certain threshold of the dollar value of the order. It's about a third, I think.
It's been a while. So it's like a de minimis rule.
Yeah, almost. Yeah, it's like these are so inconsequential, not the primary point of the order, but still necessary for performance. We can include these other items in with your GSA schedule. So yeah, Lisa put the acronym in the chat here. They're called order level materials, OLMs. And now every scheduled contract has a SIN for OLMs where you can do, again, you can add certain materials to your order.
Got it. Now, Ryan, I'm going to ask a question, a very probably federal supply schedule geeky question. Is that OLM that you don't otherwise offer under your schedule, is it now subject to the industrial funding fee, or is that still carved out?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating question. It's not just the IFF applicability, it's everything, right? How do you determine their fair and reasonable prices? How do you roll them up to the federal government order? So, I actually haven't looked for guidance on this particular question. So I might have to circle back to the team. My understanding is you still do pay IFF on those OLM, the whatever materials you're adding in, but I'll do some frantic searching here as we go to the next topic.
Yeah, I'm really, really curious. If any of you out there know the answer to that question, I'd love to hear it from you. Lisa just jumped in. I believe you still pay IFF on OLMs. Okay. Which in the past, with regard to off-schedule purchases, the contractor was specifically required under invoices to say, this is not a schedule item. And that made clear to everybody, because it's not a schedule item, there's not going to be an industrial funding fee that's going to be required at the end of the day when the government does its audit.
And one final point on those, Steve, too. OLMs you can only use for specific contract types. I don't know if we're going to talk about T&M or labor hour contracts, but when you're selling services through those two contract types, you can add the materials as OLMs, whereas open market items you can add to any invoice through any contract vehicle. So there are some limitations on the use of OLM. Open market just might be the better way to do it, depending on what you're selling.
Okay. With regard to contract types, back in the day, again, pre-late 1980s, contractors were only permitted to offer supplies under a federal supply schedule on a fixed price basis. Today, with the addition of services, contractors are permitted to offer fixed price, time and materials, or labor hour pricing. What is not permitted is for the government to ever use a cost reimbursement type order under a federal supply schedule contract. The reason for that is, and we're going to talk about it a little bit more in depth in FAR Part 12, is cost reimbursement contracting is prohibited when purchasing a commercial product or a commercial service. So again, once services were added to the schedule, they added time and materials, and they added labor hour. Notwithstanding, as Ryan, as you and I both know, the preference is always going to be for fixed price, whether it's product or service. For the government to make a determination that labor hour or time and materials will be used, they have to submit a written justification for that reason. And more often than not, it is because they can't properly estimate at the time of award what a firm fixed price will be because of certain complexities or what have you. Or in many instances, Ryan, because it's industry standard to buy that service in the commercial marketplace on a T&M or labor hour basis.
Right. Yeah. And Lisa has asked this question twice in here, Steve. So let's just hit on it quickly. So Lisa's question is, are G&A fees allowed on proposals from GSA schedule contractors? So Lisa, this strikes me as a very fast, specific question that's coming in. I will say, traditionally, the way the program is supposed to work, that's all negotiated as part of your GSA, we'll just call it your labor category price. So engineer one is this amount per hour. That includes, the underlying cost of the labor, your G&A, overhead, your profit, all of that is baked into your price. So as an ordering entity contracting officer, when you're soliciting proposals from a GSA schedule contractor, you should just be getting 100 hours, engineer one at $100, whatever it is for the person. You shouldn't theoretically be seeing any additional G&A overhead or other type of fees associated with that. But again, there might be some nuance here about your specific facts that we don't have that makes it a little bit tougher to answer.
Well, I think the nuance for that, Ryan, is I have often seen prime contractors potentially adding a handling fee or an administrative fee for subcontractor costs. And in that case, it's a negotiated rate. It's not something that the government is going to say, give me your actual cost support for this handling fee.
Yeah.
And in a lot of instances, the handling fee is often proven because this is what we, again, have offered under our commercial contracts when using subcontractors. So yeah. I have seen that. And in fact, the whole concept of handling fees actually pops up in 52212-1, alt one that deals with services with regard to what happens in when you do have subcontractors. And again, it's a flat rate. And also, it's also very important that in a federal supply schedule contract, as well as a FAR Part 12 commercial contract, the government is never going to be have any obligation or have any right to seek what your profit is. That is simply, as you stated, all of that is fully burdened into a single labor rate and or firm fixed price. The government's not going to have visibility into how that price is built up or how your labor rate has come to fruition, because you're going to justify it based upon what you've offered in the past. Now, Ryan, I would be remiss if we had a conversation about FAR Part 8 and didn't talk about a most favored customer or most favored customers and how the government uses that in determining whether the labor hour rate, for example, you're providing is fair and reasonable without unbundling the labor rate to see what the segregable portions are.
Yeah, and earlier on, I alluded to the two compliance frameworks within the schedules program. And this becomes particularly important when we talk about most favored customers, because the concept really only applies in the old commercial sales practices format submission, where you have to detail to the government all of the discounts you give to all of your classes of customers, whether it's commercial, you know, resellers, whatever it might be. And you establish, you know, what's commonly referred to as a most favored customer, but in GSA terminology is called your basis of award customer. And that's a term that can actually mean a group of customers, but it's the most comparable customer to GSA and to which your pricing through the schedules program is going to be pegged. So if you provide a lower price to that basis of award customer, you have to then provide a corresponding discount to GSA customers before your next transaction, or else run afoul of what's called the price reductions clause. So that's the clause that says you shall give that price reduction, and if not, we're going to come after you for some money. Now, GSA has moved away from this concept in this new transactional data reporting rule pilot program, where instead of filling out a form with your various categories of customers and the corresponding discounts, you just report all of your sales. And theoretically, GSA uses that sales data to then drive lower prices from your catalog pricing. So we'll see what the future of the GSA pilot program is going to be. But for any contractors that are still in the CSP format, that the most favored customer concept still is very much alive and well there.
Under a federal supply schedule contract, a federal agency contracting officers, other than within a GSA, are you able to use that contract to order? To issue orders, task orders for services, delivery orders for supplies. They have the ability to award an order on a sole source basis, and all those are identified in 8.405. If those conditions exist, they have the ability to order them on a one-off competitive basis. Either all eligible contractors under the schedule or a certain number, more limited number of schedule contractors. They also have the ability to add another layer to the ordering process. And the government will often issue under a federal government supply schedule contract a request for responses to what's called a blanket purchase agreement. And the blanket purchase agreement will identify to interested offerers a specific product or service that's needed over a period of time. I've often seen, Ryan, 1 year with 3 1-year options, 1 year with 4 1-year options. The government will use the BPA to help streamline the process to acquire a need that they know is going to continue over a long period of time. And the government will tell contractors, we intend to issue a BPA either to one offerer for a particular product or service, or we intend to issue a BPA to multiple contractors over a period of time for a particular product or service. And the reason why the government will do that is to try to force pricing down. They also do it to try to streamline the process, because once that BPA is placed, that's the last, if it's a single award, that's the last acquisition it needs to make. And then it simply issues orders from that to that one contractor. No more competition. There's only one competitive level. If there are multiple BPA awardees, the expectation is that everyone who is interested in getting a BPA is going to drop their pricing to win that limited number of spots. But they also need to understand that once there are multiple BPA holders, the government is then going to compete amongst the BPA holders, which will require pricing to go further down. Again, to streamline the process, because in that instance, the government doesn't have to issue a GSA e-buy request for quotations to all eligible contractors. It'll be a RFQ to only the limited number of BPA holders under that contract. So they use it as a basis for streamlining the acquisition process, but the government will also use it to help push down offered pricing for a product or service. Very effectively, I might add, the 4 sole source award exceptions is if there's an urgent and compelling need. We've heard that before. If there's only one source capable of providing the product or service, we've heard that before. And I'm sorry, there's only 3. And if there's a logical follow-on exception. Ryan, can you briefly tell us about what this is?
The logical follow-on exception?
Yes.
It's a logical follow-on to the preceding contract, of course, Steve.
It's the government has the ability to issue a sole source if it's already been competed before, it's already been awarded on a competitive basis. Oh, and the last is, under the GSA schedule, the government has the ability to issue on a sole source basis to meet its minimum guarantee under the schedule. Back in the day, the minimum guarantee for a federal supply schedule contract holder was $2,500. So, and that's a promise that at the end of your contract, you should have been awarded at least $2,500. They can award a sole source to do that as well. Let's talk, Ryan, really quickly about acquisition for information technology. From my perspective, the important thing that the government understands when they are procuring information technology is the risks that are involved with regard to the development of software, which from my perspective has always been, it's kind of like building a house. It always takes longer than you think, and it's always going to cost more than you think. When I worked in-house for a IT company, we always insisted that we would not perform a software development contract on a firm fixed price basis because of the internal risks. It just happens. The government needs to be concerned about obsolescence when it purchases IT, whether hardware or software, because development goes fast. And the last thing you want to be providing to your end user customers is technology that's outdated over a period of time. There should always be some built-ins for innovation and for further development and the ability to purchase upgrades under a particular contract. The government needs to be aware of the built-in IT security of whatever you're purchasing. We're going to talk about specifics at a later episode with regard to some of the new computer safeguards under NIST 800-171 that deals with cybersecurity. The government needs to be aware of Section 508 requirements, which is a series of rules that informs contractors that they have to make available hardware and software and services that is easily accessible to people who have some form of a handicap. And the rules are set forth, again, at section 508.gov. So if you see a section 508 contract provision, it will identify what are the specific requirements that need to be provided in that hardware, in that software, in telecommunications equipment, if you're developing a particular website for the government to make it accessible to people with handicaps. There often is a misunderstanding that the government, when it says there's a Section 508 requirement for hardware, that contractor equipment needs to be accessible. And that's not the case. It's what you're delivering to the government. There are situations where a IT hardware, IT software, some form of telecommunications equipment or services cannot comply with Section 508. A contractor can still submit a proposal, but the important thing is that they don't state that it is compliant, because the government has the ability to procure a non-Section 508 compliant hardware, software, or services if it's not available. And they didn't receive bids that were available that demonstrated full compliance. The important thing is that your proposal makes clear to the government that there are some gaps in your proposal. The last thing I want to talk about very briefly, because we're going to
briefer than Steve imagined it was going to be on Far Part 51. So just really briefly, I know we have a minute left here. So Far Part 51 details when contractors can use government sources. So the most common example is when the contractor can actually buy through the Federal Supply Schedule program because it's performing a contract on behalf of the federal government. So FAR 51-102 details the factors that need to be involved when the contractor is, or when the government is granting the contractor what's called a letter of authorization to use these mandatory sources of supply, including the schedules program. And 103 talks specifically about, 51-103 talks specifically about the rules governing the contractor's use of the Federal Supply Schedule program. So I think the key takeaway there is, while the contractor is entitled to GSA schedule pricing, and giving that contractor the schedule pricing as the schedule holder won't trigger any price reductions clause obligations, from a compliance perspective, you need to ensure that those transactions still are coded as GSA, you're still paying as IFF, even though the vendor in your system might be categorized as a commercial entity. So there are limits about when you can use the FAR Part 51 letters of authorization, and the solicitation specifically has to tell the contractor that they can use FAR Part 51, and that solicitation clause is 52251-1. And Steve, we did it. I wrapped it up for you. There's nothing left to cover.
And I'm back. I apologize for that. But you're absolutely right. One of the things we need to understand is when the government uses FAR Part 51, the contractor, the prime contractor, steps into the shoes of the government, and they're required to make sure that they enforce the rules of their subcontractor's schedule when they're doing business under 52251-1, which is the clause that will be in your prime contract that allows you to do that. All right. So, Brian, once again, many, many thanks for helping out. We're always thrilled to have you. We're looking forward to March Madness. I understand you're going to be playing along with us, and Patrick's going to give us the third password.
Yes, our third password for today is OPERA, O-P-E-R-A. OPERA.
All right. We've got a winner. We've got multiple winners. People were waiting.
Okay. And yeah, we do have one last poll as well, which I'll put up now. But
fantastic. And so until we meet you guys 2 weeks from now, and like I said, we'll be sending you two brackets. We're going to be sending you the March Madness bracket, and we're going to be sending you the Fun with the FAR bracket as well. Hope you're willing to join us in the fun on that. But until we see each other 2 weeks from now, work hard, play fair, and go farther. Thanks for joining us.